to the new and improved Not Alone podcast. I'm Samuel Fredrickson.
And I'm Jason Moitoso.
And we are back and back for good. We're never leaving you again. Never.
Except never again. Me.
What? Well, yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Yes. Eventually.
So, just because this is the first episode of the new and improved Not Alone podcast, I'm gonna really quick just kind of go over what that means, because I've been saying it for like months now and it hasn't meant anything. So I quit my job. That's exciting. And
wait,
we're gonna
did you actually
do
put in...
Yeah. And we're gonna do this every week. And if it doesn't work, me and my family are gonna starve. That's not true. We'll be fine. But because of that, we are gonna do this every week. We're going to be doing a hour-long episode, try to keep it at a tight hour. We also are reintroducing our Patreon level, Patreon tiers. So head over to patreon.com/notalonepodcast to learn more about that. We're doing like a level where you can, we'll do like a Facebook Live every month and you can just like ask us questions and talk to us or whatever. That kind of make, it seems as though we think highly of ourselves when I say that. We don't, but people have mentioned that that would be something that they would like.
What?
Right?
To actually communicate with us? No,
well,
we don't want that.
Just me being me being like, if you pay us money, you'll get the chance to talk to us. That's not how we feel. Then we will have another super secret tier that I'm still trying to figure out, where we do at least me and you, the listener, and maybe Jason if he has time, we do a book club every other month, and we find a spooky book and we talk about it. The first one is going to be Jacques Vallée, Passport to Magonia.
Well, so, if there's an audiobook version of it,
yeah, there
I
is.
I can probably do it.
There we go. Good idea. There we go. So, yeah, that's really what it is.
Okay.
We're back. Monthly or weekly episodes, hour-long episodes. The episodes themselves, we might have a little bit of a different kind of content that we cover. Here's the thing. We're just kind of running out of things, as we have been, which means not that we can't do the show, but just that we have to expand it. So, for instance, coming up in this next year, we're going to be talking about Aleister Crowley. We're going to be talking about secret societies. We're going to be talking about the history of witch trials and what that looks like.
I think our most previous expedition with alchemy
also
kind of highlights that and somewhat of what we're going to be talking about today, too.
Kind of sets the stage, as it were. So, anyway, we just wanted to give you a little update. Feel free to reach out with any questions, concerns, happy, sad thoughts, whatever.
Okay.
But today, for our first series of 2019 is dead. 2020 is the way it is.
Oh, scary.
It is scary, isn't it?
So scary.
The ceaseless flow of time is terrifying. But we have come back around the sun. We are back in the 20s. We're going to do nothing but drink and listen to jazz. That's going to be a good time till the stock market crashes in about, 8, 9 years. I can't remember exactly.
29.
Yeah, 9 years. Perfect. Live it up. And then we'll have the 30s, which were not a good time for anybody. The 40s, things were getting better for white people. The 50s, things were really good for white people. And then the 60s and 70s, where things started to kind of shake up, but still predominantly good for white people. I'm just saying, history is terrible.
Unless
what?
You're a white person.
Well, yes.
That's what you're saying.
The undercurrent.
With that out of the way.
Now that we've addressed decades, centuries of systemic racism.
Speaking of decades and a century.
Okay.
We're about to go back 102 years.
Wow.
Technically about 103 now.
I know. You know what's sad is the first time I thought about doing this series was in 2017 when it would have been, coincided with the 100 year anniversary. But whatever, that's fine. This week, this month, actually, we are examining one of the most astonishing events of the 20th century from a paranormal perspective, supernatural perspective, paranormal perspective. This is, I'll put a disclaimer out here, and I'll say this is a topic that, like I said, I've wanted to do for like 2 years now, but it is frankly a little bit hairy, a little bit touchy. And the reason why...
I thought you were going to say religious.
Well, that's the reason why. We are going to be talking about one specific Marian apparition. At least that's going to be the focus of...
What's a Marian apparition, Sam?
I'm so glad you asked. I'll get to it.
Oh.
Thanks.
Oops. My bad.
We're going to be focusing on one specific apparition for the first three episodes. And then at the end of the month, we'll do like a little wrap up of like, oh, this is kind of like a history of this phenomena. And this is how they're verified. So a Marian apparition is an appearance of the Blessed Virgin Mary, who, of course, is a she's a very big deal all around, but particularly in Catholicism. This, as far as I can tell, is pretty much the only tradition where Marian apparitions take place, or at least their adherents are typically Catholic, or they then become Catholic after the fact, as we'll see. So I reached out to a number of Catholics that I know, and I said, would this be bad for us to talk about? Would it be wrong? And they said, I don't think so. You guys are typically pretty respectful about that sort of stuff. And, you know, as long as we treat it like we treat everything else, it should be fine. So I look forward to your letters, if not. Or
letters.
If you disagree.
Wow. Well, handwritten letters.
No, no, no. Oh, that reminds me of another Patreon tier. Everybody who signs up gets a sticker and a handwritten thank you note from me and or Jason.
Sam, I've seen your handwriting.
It's bad. So, thank you for,
good luck
for reminding me that.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we're going to go ahead. We'll get started, sure, and we'll just see what happens. We have here episode one of the Fatima apparitions, or Our Lady of Fatima. Or is it Fatima? I'm pretty sure it's Fatima. Yeah, okay. He's saying yes. I've spent, 20 hours researching this, and I never thought to...
I'm like 95%
sure. Look up a pronunciation. I'm sure.
I should just call my dad.
You should. He's Portuguese. I needed someone to read Portuguese this past month, and he couldn't help.
You didn't ask, first off.
Could you have translated documents?
Google can.
I know. That's what I had to do.
All right. It's probably fine. Plus, I'm sure the version of Portuguese my dad knows... it's probably different than the version of Portuguese that they spoke or wrote 100 years ago. My dad's actually from the Azores Islands, not mainland Portugal, Iberia. So I'm assuming it's slightly different. What he knows is primarily like slang terminology and stuff like that. So
that's cool.
Local dialects.
There we go. I dig it.
Wild.
So Our Lady of Fatima is an event, basically a six-month-long event that culminates in one of the most well-attested public spectacles of supernatural phenomena of the 20th century, if not all time, which is something called the Miracle of the Sun, which is really technically what this whole series is about, is that one day in October of 1917 when... oh, I don't know, something like 70,000 people saw the sun start to dance and fall to the earth. So we'll be talking about that. That's actually what our second episode is all going to be about. But we cannot ignore the very important context of this miracle. In the Catholic Church, the miracles are a testimony. They're a sign of saying, look, like this is something quote unquote verifiable. And so we're going to take you through all of this. And then you can make your own decision at the end of the day. So, Jason, anything you want to say before we get started?
No, I'm excited. Let's hop on in.
Okay. Our story at this point, mm-hmm, and really throughout, is going to focus on three young children who are the witnesses to truly miraculous things. The three children were 10-year-old Lucia dos Santos, who everybody calls Lucy, and I'm going to do that too, and her two cousins, 8-year-old Francisco Marto and 7-year-old Jacinta Marto. Now, this took place near the city of Fatima in Portugal, or actually within the city of Fatima in a specific area called the Cova da Iria. So, Fatima was named after a Moorish princess. See, I heard this name. Well, I actually first heard about this when I was like 14, and I would just watch like History Channel at like 2 a.m., which is...
Oh, so it was aliens.
Yeah, when they show the spooky stuff.
That makes sense.
And so I first heard about this when I was like 14, and then as I grew up, I saw this name, Fatima, and I saw that it was a predominantly used in Muslim countries as a Muslim name. And I was like, what? That's an interesting name for a city in Portugal to have. And so that I was very interested to learn why that was the case. It turns out that Fatima was the name of a Moorish princess. So as a tiny, tiny little history lesson, the Moors, they came and they took Spain and Portugal.
And Islamic culture came and conquered most of Spain and Portugal through northern Africa.
Yes, exactly. Thank you, Jason. Then they went up Spain and Portugal, they grabbed it. And then the Crusades, some of the Crusades, there were other ones. But
right.
One specific one came in and tried. And
wasn't quite the whole
for
land,
a very long time.
Yeah.
Yes, in a process known as Reconquest. So the story comes from the time of Reconquest. Fatima was a Moorish princess who, depending on which source you ask, either fell in love with a Christian knight and converted to Christianity while living in the area that would become the town of Fatima, or she was kidnapped and forced to convert at the risk of her own life in the area that would later become a town bearing her name. There's not a lot of evidence either way, but we do know how Crusaders typically functioned, and it was typically the latter. There's that.
Yeah, knight in shining armor is a newer idea.
Yeah.
So
now the town has been up for around 500 years now. It's not particularly large. Even just today, it still has a population of just under 12,000, with a population density of just 430 people per square mile, which is ridiculously low.
And I mean, in beautiful. Portugal, though, it is like a little bit more inland, not any near most major port systems. So It doesn't quite surprise me that it hasn't expanded too much in that last 400 years up until the point of our story.
Yeah.
Really? In the last 100 now.
Yeah. That's fair.
But rolling scrubland, right? For the most part?
Yeah. Hills, I think. Pretty sure there are hills. It's a beautiful place, I'm sure. I'd like to see it one day. And we'll talk about that. Kind of? Not really. I don't know what I mean by
pilgrimage?
That. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Now.
Of sorts.
These three children. Well, first off, as we said, they were children. They were 10 years old, 8 years old, and 7 years old.
So these are kids.
These are babies. Here's the thing. We wouldn't have survived in any time and place other than when we were born.
Well, I probably would have died the first couple of years.
Yeah, well, that's true. Just from a numbers standpoint, that's very true.
But I was not a healthy child.
If we were fortunate enough to make it to 7 years old... at that point, you start working, you start joining the family business, taking care of things around the house, as opposed to me, who at 7 was beating levels of Legend of Zelda for my brother, thinking that was the good little brother thing to do, and he was not very happy about that. He was not.
I believe that.
He felt like I robbed him of something.
I truly do not know what I was doing at 7.
Yeah.
No idea. Yeah.
But these kids were shepherding. See, Lucy had been a shepherd for 2 years by the time that our story opens.
Oh, my God, that was first grade.
In 1917. Yeah.
That's what I was doing. I was in first grade.
You were learning your letters.
I was watching a lot of Digimon.
Wow.
That's what I was doing.
All right.
Anyway, sorry. There we go. Memory lane. Continue.
Thank you. Lucy had been a shepherd for about 2 years when our story opens in 1917.
Lucy's the oldest as well, right?
Yes, yeah. Okay. So she's 10 in 1917. So she started when she was about 8.
Ah, good age. Yep. Solid age.
Yep. She had started under the tutelage of some local boys and girls, but now she was the leader of her family's flock. See, her older sister, Carolina, was the shepherdess before her, but she had grown to the ripe old age of 13 years old and had to go get a real job to support the family. So, thus, it had fallen to young 8-year-old at the time, Lucy, to watch the sheep. And then after a few years, her parents thought she could do it alone. And she did. She was a very good shepherdess. Now, her cousins, Jacinta and Francisco, they spent all their time together anyway. They were very, very close. And so, basically, the way it then worked is that the cousins would come with her to watch her flock, but their own family had some sheep as well, and they said, let us take the sheep out, we can take care of them, and then whoever's doing that can go get a real job, and then, you know, we can just spend all our days together and play and frolic. And it took a few years to convince their mother of this, but finally, the little Martos were able to. And then what would happen is Lucy and her cousins would meet up at a pond every morning. They'd combine their flocks. They'd go have the day together. Then they'd come back, separate the flocks, and go home. So they're hardworking children. They're very dedicated children. They are also extremely pious kids as well. Lucy and her cousins, particularly Jacinta, had a great love of religion and of God and of Jesus and all of that. Lucy had learned to say the Hail Mary when she was so young she was still able to be held in her mother's arms. She had learned the catechism and took her first communion when she was only 6 years old. Typically, the church does not administer, as far as I could tell, does not administer a first communion beneath 7 years old. But she was ready for it then. In fact, she was originally told that already she, although she was ready and she had an understanding of the faith that surpassed children older than her, she would simply have to wait. And then the local bishop was like, what? She's fine. She's fine. Look at her. She knows what's going on. She's a very able-minded six-year-old. And then they did that. So that was pretty cool.
Okay.
So we have a potent combination here. We have self-reliant kids who are basically, by all accounts, living the dream, right?
Out in the wilderness.
Out in the wilderness all day.
With their cousins.
And they don't, like, make any bones about it. They play around, and they play games, and they have their little lunch, and it's just, like, a great time.
Well, yeah, they don't know that school's not an option.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. They don't know how to read at this point. They're just living their life in the hillside, and it's awesome, and they love it.
Blissful ignorance?
I guess. I don't even think it's ignorance. I think it's just bliss. I think they're just like killing it all day, every day. Now, the majority of the events that take place in our series here are going to take place in the year 1917. However, there is actually some stories from before the apparition, the Marian apparition, that took place in 1915 while Lucy was still tending the flocks with those older local boys and girls. See, like I said, she's extremely pious. 1915, she would have been 8. She would have been confirmed Catholic for 2 years at that point. She took to praying the rosary as often as she could, especially as she was out with the sheep. And she would often get her older cousins, or not cousins, the older kids in the village, to do it, pray along with her. Now, one day, they were doing this after lunch, and as they did, there was a glorious, shining figure that appeared in the sky, hovering above some nearby trees. Lucy claimed it looked like, quote, a statue made of snow, rendered almost transparent by the rays of the sun. Now the figure, unquote, the figure disappeared once they had ended their prayer. She claimed that the features of the figure were indistinguishable other than its general shape and size. But the following year, the same event would happen again in the company of the same children in the same place during the same prayers of the rosary. These experiences led to Lucy, for the first time in her memory, being treated poorly by her family. See, she was always a bit of a golden girl for the first, 8 years of her life, as most of us probably were. You know, they love you.
Can't really
you.
Do much wrong at that point.
Yeah, they love you. You're out, you're tending the sheep. It's a great time. And then she comes home and she starts telling her parents about this. This is, again, a very formative. This experience determines what happens in later experiences. Because as she tells her family about this, they're just very mean about it. There's no...
Oh, it's a phase kind of a thing.
I guess.
Probably or, potentially something like that.
Or a my daughter is a terrible little liar face kind of a thing, which is not good. There's not a lot written about how Lucy's father reacts to this. As we'll see, her father may or may not have had some other issues going on at the time. But Lucy's mother, at the very least, did kind of take that hard line of like, well, you're lying and it's not good to lie. So tell me the truth that this didn't happen. And then her sister, at one point, Lucy refers to this angel as being it was as though he was wrapped in a sheet, which is why she couldn't distinguish his features. And so at one point, Lucy's like asking a question about something. And her older sister, Carolina, is like, why don't you go ask somebody wrapped in a sheet, Lucy? And just, like, is very mean to her, it would sound like.
Wow. Okay.
Yes. Now, I am getting all of this from Lucia's memoirs, which we will link to in the show notes. There's a wonderful... The great thing about this whole thing is that it's extraordinarily well documented as well. Of course, the earliest years were basically just going off of Lucy's memory. But as time goes on... we start to get a lot other people writing about this and observing. But we know that later on, the exact same thing happens. And so we have really no reason to doubt that that's how her mother treated her in this first case there. So she was very sad for a very long time. It was around this time. I don't know if it's because of this or if it was just a coincidence, but it was around this time that Jacinta and Francisco were granted permission by their mother to go out and take the flocks out with her as well. So I don't know. I just as pure like spitballing and speculation, it might be that like their mother, Lucy's mother, was like worried that her daughter was lying or doing bad things, and she's like, okay, take the cousins, and they can tell us if anything goes wrong. Or again, it could just be like, all right, it's time to go to the hills, children. So there's that.
Terrifying.
It's terrifying until it's like the best day ever forever.
I mean, I guess. But they get caught in the rain later and it's...
That's true. The rain, which is a big deal, obviously. And it did one afternoon. It did begin to rain. As the children were tending their flock, as they were keeping watch over their sheep... It's like almost Christmas, and so I'm just getting a lot of like Christmas vibes out of this, I guess.
This happened in what, August?
No, it was
at this point.
It was
earlier
May.
Than that. Yeah,
it was May.
Okay, much earlier.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway,
is this you telling me to talk? What is this motion?
Let's continue.
Okay. Okay. All right.
Let's continue.
One afternoon, it did begin to rain. The children took shelter under a hanging rock ledge. To eat and play their reindeer games. It's May. When a strong wind picked up and the children perceived something moving towards them from a nearby grove of olive trees. Now, as it got closer to them, they were able to see again this shimmering, translucent being, a sculpture made of snow that was almost imperceptible when the light hit it. Just a certain way. However, unlike the other times where the sculpture, the statue, the figure stayed fairly far back, this time it got very close to them. And Lucy was actually able to see the features of this thing. She said it was, quote, a young man about 14 or 15 years old, whiter than snow, transparent as crystal when the sun shines through it, and of great beauty. On reaching us, he said, "Do not be afraid. I am the angel of peace. Pray with me." Unquote. So those first two apparitions, as far as I can tell, there was no real engagement of the shepherds, the little shepherds. They simply saw this thing, and then this thing disappeared.
Which, that is... kind of the escalation that we usually get with poltergeists and other spirits, other right?
Things other as well,
visitations.
Yes, which is what
things escalate.
Our entire third episode of this series is going to be all about UFOs and stuff like that. So, yes. Perfect. But you're right. Most paranormal phenomena has some sort of an escalation process.
You know, it's funny because, like, after Google searching it, there was a clip about, like, UFO Miracle of the Sun. I'm like, no, I'm not going to watch that. Sam will probably watch that. I'm not going to watch that. We don't have to talk about it. It'll be fine. It's just hublub.
No. It's our entire third episode. Yep.
That's exciting.
Yep. So, upon reaching them, again, the angel says, "Do not be afraid. I am the angel of peace. Pray with me." So, we have here, this is either late 1916 or early 1917. And this is...
It'd be 1917.
Mm-hmm. This is the backdrop against which the further events unfold. He says specifically, "I am the angel of peace." Around this time, of course, there was something very big happening on the global scale.
What?
World War I, the Great War, as it was called.
Yeah, but also to note on that, for the most part, Spain was completely neutral. Portugal was neutral for quite a long time until German skirmishes in northern Africa, which was right around this time point. But for the most part, it's not like it's going to be anything from home. That and German U-boats were also targeting Portuguese ships that were supplying aid to Britain at the time. So there definitely was some hostilities, but nothing that was localized to the Iberian Peninsula in any way.
But the children would have heard word. You know, maybe they wouldn't have before.
Possibly, yeah. Maybe, I don't know, like town radio or something.
Mm-hmm. Or even just adults local, talking about it, you know. Yeah. You know, you go
children
to her.
Children do tend to hear quite a bit.
They pick up a lot. I'm sure you remember from your own childhood. I remember I was just absolutely terrified after 9/11. I would like lay awake at night, just completely terrified of something happening and like people I love dying. So it's just would have been very interesting to see, be able to have like a control group of having another 26-year-old who lived in a timeline where that didn't happen and seeing like if it did make a significant impact on the development of our entire generation, because I have to assume it did, right?
Well, a pretty big deal. I mean, ever since then, we're used to being in constant conflict.
We've been in war forever. Yeah. I don't remember a time we weren't at war. This is 1984. This is dystopia.
First grade.
Yeah.
I remember a little bit of first grade.
Mm-hmm.
I remember second grade. I remember going to a neighboring classroom to watch.
I remember. I remember. I don't know why we're talking about
now,
this. But we're
now
going
I think
to.
About it, I'm like, why did they let second graders like watch this?
I remember I made it to school. A lot of kids didn't even make it to school because of the timing. I made it to school. And we did. We watched
it.
It
was like 9 a.m. or so?
Yeah, something like that. But it and we watched it, and it turned on. The TV was on, and I just saw that. And, yeah.
How did we get on this?
We're talking about traumas. The way that war affects traumas, children. Yeah. And it does. And it does. So, you know, for a number of years, the war was going on, but it sounds like Portugal wasn't very much involved at all. And then it started getting closer.
Not in a major place. It's not like they're France.
Right.
Also, of note, in 1910, there was a revolution that overthrew the monarchy in Portugal and established a republic, which historians are not so sure of how corrupt or uncorrupt this government was. But still, it was another turmoil point of time for Portugal in general.
And as we'll talk about in our next episode, that republic that was set up was an explicitly anti-clerical republic. Religion started to decline in Portugal in a way that it never had before, as we'll talk about.
I mean, when you look at it, going from a monarchy to a republic, it makes a lot of sense, especially at this point in time where turn of the century, spiritualism had already kind of done its thing. And hasn't really gotten that next little wave that it got after World War I. So, yeah, it was definitely a turning point with public opinion, And also, of course, political.
Mm-hmm.
So it's
a tumultuous time for the children.
Exactly.
As they shepherd their flocks by
night. For a bit of context of what will probably be discussed here.
Now, the little shepherds, they prayed with this angel of peace. They modeled his method of prayer, which was to bow with his forehead touching the ground and repeated words of repentance, asking for the forgiveness of those who knew and did not know God. The angel then rose and disappeared. The shepherds prayed this way every day for months. Unlike the previous encounters, this one was kept a secret by all parties involved. So,
You don't want to get scrutinized that much more.
No, exactly.
That especially, same guy came down and told me how to pray.
Yep. Especially if, like I was saying, potentially the other kids were there as any sort of a safeguard against such things happening in Lucy's mother's mind, and now it's just happening again. So, now the same angel would appear two more times, each time exhorting the children to pray. In one of these apparitions, he identified himself as the angel who was in charge of the whole of Portugal, and that their prayers could and would save their nation. Now, this is an interesting thing. Of course, while we're talking about like angels and demons, which is obviously going to have to be a big part of this series, there's this whole concept of like spiritual warfare is what it's called. And it's this idea of like angels and demons like fighting and fighting against you, like the demons fighting to take you down and like the angels there to like save you and back you up and stuff like that. Very, very much kind of like a medieval sort of philosophy and theology there that has carried over.
So wait, just like the devil and the angel on your shoulders kind of thing?
Yeah, kind of, exactly. Except the devil on your shoulder is like stabbing you in the neck repeatedly. Oh. And the angel is like wrestling him down. This is an interesting concept. It comes from a number of early religious writings. But what I find specifically interesting about the children's claim here that the angel was in charge of the whole of Portugal is that there is, in the book of Daniel, there's a story about Daniel being thrown in prison, and this angel, after like 28 days of him being in prison, this angel appears to him, and he's like, sorry I couldn't get here faster, Daniel. I was fighting the prince of Persia at the time. Now, the angel wouldn't have fought like the physical, actual person who was in charge of Persia. So this has led to an entire systematic theology, or better said, angelology and demonology, that instead of it being like a very personal, like person to person fighting, instead
it's not a fairy godmother-esque
exactly.
feel.
There is something in charge of a nation. There's something in charge of a region of a world acting on the Most High's behalf to take care of it, and then there's something acting against it. And that's what the children portray here, even though that's not a particularly popular, not even popular like people like it, but just popularly known or popularly accepted view, which is just very interesting to me that that's what this angel said to them. But that was a tiny little nerd tangent. I do not apologize. Now, the final time that the angel appeared, something else extremely interesting happened. This entire thing is just very interesting things happening one after another and another. So, the final time that the angel appears, he appears with a chalice, and above the chalice is a bit of host, of when you're taking communion, the bread is the host, and the chalice is the wine, right? Or is the blood. The body right. And the wine is the host. So there's this piece of host that is levitating above this goblet that then drips blood into the goblet. The goblet is given, the chalice is given to the children. Lucy and Jacinta both eat and drink. Francisco only drinks. He doesn't eat. And then they disappear. The angel disappears. So that's a very strange thing to happen. essentially, he's administering some kind of supernatural communion to the children. Francisco does not partake fully, but Lucy and Jacinta do. Now, this is particularly important because going forward, as we'll see in the Marian apparitions, going forward, whatever it is that's appearing is talking to Lucy and Jacinta, but Francisco cannot hear her. So it's been this kind of like idea that whatever happened here
is the catalyst for what will happen later.
It's the bridge that allows, so maybe they could all see because they all drank, but they could only hear because the two of them ate and Francisco did not. Hey everybody, it's Sam here. I just wanted to take a moment here in the middle of the episode. There are some thank yous we want to get to. So, we would like to thank, from the bottom of our hearts, Faye, Astrid, and Carlos. Those are our three new patrons that have signed up, even in the midst of our hiatus. So we really appreciate you guys for making that financial donation to the show. In addition to just the warm and fuzzy feeling you get from supporting the show, being a patron also entitles you to a number of different rewards. Anything as simple as these shout-outs, which are accompanied by a handwritten thank you note and two Not Alone stickers, which are actually pretty nice stickers. I like them a lot. I put them on everything, as Jason can attest. All the way up to getting a book in the mail every other month, and then being able to participate with me, and maybe Jason if he feels up to it, in a book club discussion. The first book of that, of 2020, which we'll be discussing next month, is going to be Jacques Vallée's Passport to Magonia. You can go to patreon.com/notalonepodcast to see all the different tiers. Again, we're talking free stickers. We're talking about every quarter getting sent another piece of free merch, whether that's a shirt, a mug, a sweatshirt, anything like that. The book club, all sorts of things. So again, you can go to patreon.com/notalonepodcast to learn how to support your favorite show. The other thing that we'd like to do really quick here is to go ahead and read out the names of people who left us iTunes reviews, 5-star iTunes reviews, as a thank you there. So, we'd like to thank Svefnoid Wing and Morgan What's-Her-Name. And we're going to go ahead and read Morgan What's-Her-Name's. They say, I love this podcast because I feel like the hosts really do their research and take people seriously. Too many people who explore the oddities in life look at it through a critical glass. The hosts have a good balance of topic content as well as a balanced view as they look at stories but keep the human aspect there. I'm always happy to hear a bit more about how we're not alone. And then they did a cool emoji with the sunglasses. So thank you, Morgan What's-Her-Name, and thank you everyone who supports the show in any way, whether that's through Patreon, whether that's through an iTunes review, or especially as we're getting this relaunch started, just by telling a friend. I did decide to focus solely on the podcast and my schooling going forward, so that way we could get back to that monthly basis or that weekly basis for episodes. So if you're able to help out in any way, again, reviews help, word of mouth helps, Patreon helps, whatever you can do, we'd appreciate it. But you know what? Even if you can't do any of that, we still love you. We still think you're worth everything in the world. And we are so, so grateful to have you as a listener. To kind of open up the spirit of podcasting collaboration, if there's a show that we like, that we think is good, we are going to grab a promo from them and play it here. This first week of 2020, the year 2020, that promo is going to be from our very good friends, Brian and Rob of the Coda Cast, the Coda Podcast, which is a podcast about the history of music and the like. So sit back and enjoy the promo trailer for the Coda Cast with Brian and Rob.
End your week on a high note with the Coda, a brand new music podcast from Brian Hasty and Rob Christofferson.
Each bi-weekly episode will touch on music news and rumors, an in-depth look at a specific topic, as well as recommendations to fill your ear holes with after each episode is done.
We'll be discussing artists ranging from Aaron Carter to Frank Zappa, and you can count on Brian waxing poetic for his love of the new metal genre of music.
The Coda, available every second Friday on every platform where podcasts can be found.
Thank you.
Shortly after this event, life for Lucy and her family gets significantly rougher. From her own account, which again we'll link to in our show notes, she recounts how her father had some sort of a habit. I don't know that it was drinking, gambling, whatever it was. It's resulted in a substantial loss of their property and their financial security. Now, her older sister was sent to work harder and more demanding jobs to make up for the loss. At one point, she vividly remembers her mother sitting at the dinner table, looking at the now vacant spots of her two elder children, because she had Carolina and then I think one other even elder sister. And her mom's just looking at these empty spots and saying, "My God, where has the joy of our home gone?" And then she like put her hands in her head and cried a lot. Now, little Lucy was unable to answer. Instead, she clung to the angel of Portugal and his words, who admonished her and her children to pray at all times in order to bring about good to her family and to her country. The final nail in the coffin leading to complete and total desperation for the Dos Santos family was a horrible illness that befell Lucy's mother. After traveling all over the country, they finally were able to discover that she had kidney failure and cardiac lesions, which sounds very bad. Painful. Very bad. Thus, on that fateful day of May 13th, 1917, it was fair to say that Lucy and her whole family were defeated and downtrodden. Now, Lucy's mother would later heal, maybe related to what we're about to talk about, maybe not. But what we're about to talk about is something that has been happening since the year 40 AD. We are going to again talk a lot more about the history of these Marian apparitions and the like in our last episode of this series, but it is something that has been around for a very long time. There's one account, like I said, from 40 AD, which is interesting because that's actually before Mary, the mother of Jesus, died. And yet, that is the first Marian apparition. So we'll talk about that. And then during the early church and the medieval period, it kind of, it's not that it falls away. It's just that the church didn't like go through validating these sorts of things and verifying them until we get to the 1500s. There you have the apparition of Our Lady of Guadalupe, which is one of the most important Marian apparitions of all time. It led to the conversion of millions of indigenous people in Mexico. And we'll talk a little bit about that again in our last episode.
Okay. And from the brief skimming that I did, it seems like apparitions of Mary are the most common.
As opposed to
any other apparition of a holy figure.
Yeah, I would say so. Okay. I think so, yeah.
And they all pretty much stem within the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
Or Catholicism in general.
Yeah, and so in Catholicism, you have this idea of Mary as definitely the mother of Jesus, which is a universal concept. But also Mary is the mother of the church. And it was actually even surprising. I posted a picture of a artist's drawing of the description that Lucy gives of the apparition that we're about to talk about. And it was a little weird. And one of our followers, well, it wasn't a little weird. It was, we'll talk about it. That's third episode UFO stuff. But anyway, one of our followers on Twitter replied and said, "Huh, what did he say?" He said, like, "I haven't seen mom look like that before." And I was like, "What?" And then I looked, and this is not a, like, this is not even a strange thing. It's just Mary is Jesus's mother and your mother too. And so that is a devotion and a closeness that is not mirrored by any other denomination. Even the Eastern Church, which of course split from the Catholic Eastern right. Orthodox, they refer to Mary not necessarily as the mother of God, but rather as the Theotokos, which means the God bearer. She bore God, but she's not necessarily the mother. It's very interesting stuff, very theologically dense. But suffice to say, Catholicism has a very special, intimate, beautiful relationship with Mary that other denominations simply don't have, which is why
Mary's so popular as a
apparition. Why it happens at all, I would say. Now, what happened? Okay. May 13th.
That is the question, yeah.
May 13th, 1917.
Okay.
What happened? It began to the children as a flash of lightning. They were atop a hill and began to be very worried that they were in danger of being struck by lightning in a thunderstorm. Thus, they began to run down the slope, leading their sheep. Halfway to the bottom, another bright flash illuminates the sky, and as they take a few steps forwards, the children are then stopped dead in their tracks, confronted with a shocking vision. This is from Lucia's memoirs, quote, "We had only gone a few steps further, when there before us was a small home oak. We beheld a lady all dressed in white. She was more brilliant than the sun and radiated a light more clear and intense than a crystal glass filled with sparkling water when the rays of the burning sun shone through it." Now, the woman, unquote, the woman spoke, quote, "Do not be afraid. I will do you no harm." The children responded, quote, "Where are you from?" The woman says, "I am from heaven." The children say, well, Lucy says, Lucy's the spokesperson from all of this. And as we'll see, there's a reason why we're getting her memoirs and her words and not the other two children. She says, "Where are you from?" And the apparition, the figure, says, "I am from heaven. What do you want of me?" And the apparition says, "I have come to ask you to come here for 6 months in succession on the 13th day at this same hour. Later on, I will tell you who I am and what I want. Afterward, I will return here yet a seventh time." Lucy then says, "Shall I go to heaven too?" "Yes, you will." Lucy says, "And Jacinta?" "She will also go." "And Francisco?" "He will go too. He will go there too, but he must say many rosaries." Then Lucy, kind of betraying her compassionate heart that she has, she asks about a companion of hers who had recently died. The companion was around 16 years old. She says, "Is Maria de Neves in heaven?" And the apparition says, "Yes, she is." And then another friend of Lucy's who had died recently, Amelia, she asks about Amelia. And the Virgin replies, quote, "She will be in purgatory until the end of the world. Are you willing to offer yourselves to God and bear all the suffering he wills to send you as an act of reparation for the sins by which he is offended and of supplication for the conversion of sinners?" The children said, "Yes, we are willing." "Then you are going to have much to suffer, but the grace of God will be your comfort." Unquote. Of all of that. That was all quotes, basically. Now, at this point, this is one of the most... it's also interesting to me, but this is one of the most fascinating parts for me. At that point, the woman opens her hands, which had been clasped together during the course of an apparition, of the apparition. The hands were holding a light. They seemed to be melded around an orb of some kind, as we'll see later. It's holding a light, and as she opens, there's a singular, or there's three rays that come straight out of the orb and pierce the children directly in the heart. And as it does, they reveal, as best as I can understand, their best selves. They have a vision of their best selves, or what they could be.
Their best selves, or like their most pious selves?
Their most pious selves. For them, it's the same.
Yeah.
Yeah. They saw what they were going to become by their communication with this being, and this led to the children falling on their knees in prayer and adoration. The woman spoke one last time. She said, quote, "Pray the rosary every day in order to obtain peace for the world and the end of the war," unquote. She then rose into the sky, traveling eastward, and faded from view. She left a trail of light behind her, which the children saw as a opening, like the sky was splitting, is how bright and luminous this trail was.
Oh, dear.
So, that was the first of six apparitions. Now, word gets around
Yeah, I was going to say, quickly. Did Lucy speak of this one?
She, it's interesting because she says she didn't, and she says nobody else did. Yet, well, first off, before we go forward, any thoughts on that? Anything thus far?
Oh, God, all of it?
Specifically, well, the apparition itself.
I found that as a bit interesting that she claims it to be more brilliant than the sun, but she's able to actually
look at it,
which tends to not really be possible. Mm-hmm. So a little bit of the description seems a bit over the top.
I will say, as we'll see in the further times that this happens, more and more people witness the event. They do not witness the Virgin, but they witness other phenomena. And when they do, they all, or not all, but a good amount of them report that Lucy would look at a spot and then she'd look away, like every few seconds, as if she couldn't stare directly at it for a very long time. Anyway,
okay,
just saying. I don't think I even put that in the notes, but...
But, no, you didn't.
I'm sorry.
You're good. But that's the only thing that I have as of right now. I mean, this is the story of young children, so there's not a whole lot that we can break down besides the fact that it was just after rain.
It was just after rain.
So
during a very, very hard time. It is a textbook case of, like, I don't know, that, like, idea of, well, people only see, like, religious things when they're in hard straits and stuff like that. It is a textbook
kind of looking for
of that,
it, yeah.
But we'll see what happens.
But we'll continue, yeah.
Yeah. So the next month, like I said, nobody's fessing up to it, but somebody talked.
Yeah, clearly.
Because there are 50 people.
So wait, was Francisco or
Jacinta
able to actually hear anything that the
Again, I believe that Jacinta
said?
Could, but okay. Francisco couldn't.
Okay.
Here's another thing.
But Lucy was the one that was doing the direct contact
she
and
was,
speaking.
She was the spokesperson on, okay. Yep. The apparition never moved her mouth either. So, something to keep in mind.
Okay.
Now, the children returned the following month as instructed. This time, they were accompanied by around 50 people. The same lightish... Why did I say that? The same lightning phenomena occurred. The woman appeared again next to the home oak. This time, the woman told small Lucy to continue praying and to return the following month and to learn to read. This was very important. Lucy, in response, asked for someone in her life to be cured of a chronic illness, and she was told that if this person would convert, they would be healed within a year. The apparition also gave the children an additional prayer to say while praying the rosary for peace. Quote, after each one of the mysteries, my children, really quick, do you know what the rosary is?
No.
Okay. I didn't know. I didn't think so. I don't understand it completely by any means, but essentially by use of a rosary, right, which is, I'm just trying to go from base level here, is strung together beads, basically.
Yeah.
And a crucifix at the bottom and a medallion of Mary somewhere on there. Basically what it is you repeat certain prayers this multiple times. You repeat Hail Mary, you repeat Our Father, you repeat Glory Be. You then do a step of contemplation on the mysteries. And there's like 4 or 5 different mysteries. I'm so sorry to all my Catholic friends that I'm just butchering this explanation. You have like the luminous mysteries, the suffering mysteries, the joyful mysteries. And basically what this means is you contemplate actions or events in the life of Jesus and the life of Mary. So you contemplate like when the angel announced that she was going to give birth. You contemplate the crucifixion. You contemplate the healings and the resurrection, stuff like that. So when she says after each one of the mysteries, that's what she's talking about there. So anyway, sorry.
Oh, no. It was worth it.
Quote, after each one of the mysteries, my children, I want you to pray in this way. Oh, my Jesus, forgive us our sins. Save us from the fires of hell. Take all souls to heaven, especially those who are most in need. That's the prayer. And then the apparition says, I want you to learn to read and write, and later I will tell you what else I want of you, unquote. Lucy then asks to be taken to heaven, right there, right then and there, which again goes far in explaining the kind of piety and mindset that these children have.
Well, I mean, two of her friends are recently deceased. So the idea that
there's a war on
the fixation to this mortal plane is pretty minimal.
Her dad has some sort of a problem and her mom is like dying.
Yeah.
It's not a great life for Lucy right now. She says she has to be taken to heaven. The woman states that she will be eventually, not right now, and that she would take Jacinta and Francisco soon. But Lucy had to remain a while longer. This is one of those things, as we go, that has been validated by other accounts. For instance, she told this to, once all of this got out, she started being interviewed by like the bishops and all sorts of things in the region. This is something that she told to other bishops. So keep that in mind as we go forward here. But, okay. This caused Lucy to be sad, but the apparition told her not to be sad. She would not be alone. The woman would be with her always. Again, the woman opened her hands, and the same effect was achieved with the exact words from Lucy's memoirs used to describe the experience as, quote, "We saw ourselves in this light, as it were, immersed in God," unquote. So whatever that means. It's crazy. It's awesome. I love it.
I don't know. A lot of light? Is that what it is?
I don't know, man.
Okay.
This is a very mystical experience.
Right,
this
is
very much like the union of the disparate soul to its higher creator force and like joining together. And it's very cool. I love it. Now, the children were then asked to make sacrifices for the conversions of sinners. At the first, the children were unaware of what kind of sacrifices they were being asked to make. They didn't want to, like, slaughter their sheep or anything. They were worried about that, I guess, for a minute.
Yeah, and then I mean, that's the livelihood of their entire family.
Yeah, yeah. And then they understood, either because they were told or something, I can't remember how they understood, but they understood that this meant that whatever evil fell their way, whatever bad things happened to them, they were to offer that up as a sacrifice. Furthermore, as we'll see, the children began to engage, Jacinta, at the very least, began to engage in a more ascetic practice that we'll talk about as well from there. So, anyway. Now, during the ensuing month, Lucy became very concerned about the nature of the apparitions. Words continued to get around. Her pastor claimed that it could very well be the devil who was causing these apparitions and not God. And so,
when, a lesson in trickery, huh?
When the third month, July 13th, once it rolled around, she had initially decided she was not going to go. But, and here's another key point, for reasons that she could not understand or put into words, she just changed her mind. She woke up that morning saying, "I'm not doing this." And then the next thing she knows, she was like, "You know what? It's fine. Let's go." Keep that in mind.
Mind control.
She went again with her cousins to the Cova da Iria, which is an area that was owned by Lucy's family. It was their grazing land from there. Now, upon the third apparition, a similar formula was repeated wherein Lucy asked what the apparition wanted. The apparition said that she wanted prayer and for the children to respond to this spot in the following month. She, Lucy again asked for like healing for sick people in the village and all of that. Especially, again, there was, I don't know the numbers of the crowd this time, but there was another crowd bigger than before, came with her, asked for healing for the people in the crowd as well as people in her life. Again, at some point in all of this, her mother does get healed. I think it's fairly near the start. But there are two significant variations that happened this time that didn't happen the previous time. The first was that Lucy asked for the apparition to perform a miracle in some way that would convince the skeptical regarding the authenticity of the children's experience. She asked the apparition to identify itself and to tell the children who she was. Now, to this, the apparition stated that in the month of October, she would in fact reveal who she was, what she wants, and perform a miracle for all to see and believe. This satisfied the children. They consented. The apparition told them to sacrifice themselves for sinners, explained that some of the people they brought before her would be healed and some others would not be. And then the second major variation occurred at the opening of her hands. Now, the most intriguing thing from a secular point of view, or even not just a secular, but just somebody outside of the whole phenomena point of view, what's so interesting about Fatima is the secret. There is a secret in three parts that the apparition gives to the child. The secret, we have evidence that they had it as early as they said they had it here, for a reason that we'll see very plainly in a moment. The secret would then be kept for something like 40 years, at which point two of its three parts were revealed. The third part would not be revealed until around the year 2000. So, we're actually in a move very, very much like the Catholic Church. We are not going to reveal the third part of the secret on our program. We will be revealing it, as well as the conspiracy that surrounds it, in our bonus episode this month for our $5 patrons and above. But we are going to go through and do these first two bits of the secret that have been revealed. So, the Virgin opens her hands, or the apparition opens her hands. Before, twice now, before, the children had been bathed in light. They had seen themselves in God and God in themselves in the light. And this time they had a very, very different experience. Now,
what do they see?
Lucy says, quote, "She showed us a great sea of fire, which seemed to be under the earth. Plunged in this fire were demons and souls in human form, like transparent burning embers, all blackened or burnished bronze, floating about in the conflagration, now raised into the air by the flames that issued from within themselves, together with great clouds of smoke, now falling back on every side like sparks in a huge fire, without weight or equilibrium, and amid shrieks and groans of pain and despair, which horrified us and made us tremble with fear. The demons could be distinguished by their terrifying and repellent likeness to frightful and unknown animals, all black and transparent. This vision lasted but an instant. How can we ever be grateful enough to our kind Heavenly Mother, who had already prepared us by promising in the first apparition to take us to heaven? Otherwise, I think we would have died of fear and terror, unquote. That's the first part of the secret.
That's some old school gothic era.
That is some heavy
scary
stuff.
Scary into church kind of stuff.
That is some heavy, heavy stuff. It is extremely metal, unbelievably metal. It's there, man. Now, this was immediately followed. That's the first part of the secret. This was immediately followed by the second part of the secret, which came from the mouth of the apparition herself. So as opposed, well, not her mouth, because again, she wasn't moving her mouth, but quote, "You have seen hell, where the souls of poor sinners go. To save them, God wishes to establish in the world devotion to my Immaculate Heart. If what I say to you is done, many souls will be saved, and there will be peace. The war is going to end. But if people do not cease offending God, a worse one will break out during the pontificate of Pius XI. When you see a knight illumined by an unknown light, know that this is the great sign given to you by God that he is about to punish the world for its crimes by means of war, famine, and persecutions of the Church and of the Holy Father. To prevent this, I shall come to ask for the consecration of Russia to my Immaculate Heart and the communion of reparation on the first Saturdays. If my requests are heeded, Russia will be converted and there will be peace. If not, she will spread her errors throughout the world, causing wars and persecutions of the Church. The good will be martyred, the Holy Father will have much to suffer, various nations will be annihilated. In the end, my Immaculate Heart will triumph. The Holy Father will consecrate Russia to me, and she will be converted, and a period of peace will be granted to the world." Unquote. So, those were the secrets. Or that was the secret that the children saw, that they experienced. And, as you might imagine, messed them up. Really?
Yeah, I think it's interesting how it is specifically Russia as the country.
Mm-hmm.
Because Russia is so large, it spans so many different types of people.
Mm-hmm.
That it's still interesting that she specifically points out Russia as the country, not like a regional area.
Because of this,
not like, I don't know, Siberia.
Because of this, especially with the second secret being revealed, when was it? I can't remember. It was sometime in the 40s. The second secret was revealed when Lucia wrote her memoirs, is how it got revealed, in the 40s. So, especially because it came out around that time, this has also led to kind of this syncretization between the apparition, Our Lady of Fatima, being a force against communism specifically. Like, this is the supernatural force that's going to defeat communism, or is at least its avatar. So right. I think that's like an interesting side effect of what happened here. But anyway, the children were awestruck. They were disturbed. They were calmed. They were excited. They were terrified. They were joyful. They may as well have been split in two.
Well, yeah, I mean, first they only had to pray for Portugal. Now they have to essentially pray to save the entire
world.
That's a lot. That's some heavy burden to put on three kids.
Yeah, it's wild.
That add up to like our age.
And now to put on
younger than us.
Everyone. I know, yeah. Right?
It's 25.
Woof.
Yeah.
Now.
Of shared experience.
The apparition then taught them a new prayer to be recited at the end of each decade, which is one of the beads on the rosary, upon which a prayer to the Virgin Mary is said. The children were instructed to pray thusly. It's very similar to the previous one they were instructed. O my Jesus, forgive us all our sins, save us from the fires of hell, and lead all souls to heaven, especially those in most need of your mercy. The children agreed. The apparition ended. And the following month of waiting was a time of great change and turmoil for the children. On one hand, the children were disturbed by the vision of hell that they had experienced. Jacinta specifically seemed to suffer immensely. She spent her days in constant prayer and supplication on behalf of those she had seen in hell and for those on earth whose salvation was not assured. This, as all of the prayers of the children had been directed to pray, reflects a very peculiar bit of Catholic soteriology, which are acts of reparation. I could talk about this for a good hour or so, but I'm not going to. Suffice to say, it's another thing that I think is fairly unique. I don't know, but it's this idea that when you plead forgiveness for others, even if they're not repentant, it can have an effect. It can repair things and return them back to their natural state. One contemporary example of this actually happened just a month ago, not even a month ago when we're recording this. There was in Houston near the end of November 29th, there was a public black mass that was held with patrons paying up to $666 for a ticket. The local and international Catholic community then responded with prayers of reparation in order to repair the breach. Again, it's very non-concrete. It's very hard to say exactly what I think is happening here and what's not. But again, it's about returning things back to the way they should be from there. So this is what occupied Jacinta's mind both day and night, and the rest of the children to a lesser degree. They did not share their vision with others. They kept it a secret between themselves, but they did somehow let out that there was a secret, something that they saw that they weren't going to share. So Jacinta was taken to inflicting various minor sufferings on herself as sacrifices in an attempt to save the sinners in hell or those who were in purgatory or yet living and in danger of hell. She would eat bitter acorns and olives. She would give away her lunch to the poor, children.
That makes sense. Yeah.
She poured out her own water for the sheep on particularly hot days. However, the press caught wind of these events, which at that point had been witnessed. Something had been witnessed by hundreds. Again, there's only one account of somebody other than the children seeing the apparition itself. But there are thousands of accounts of various like lighting phenomena, sound phenomena. We're going to get into all of that in episode 3. This then, because the press got wind of it, they started publishing about it. Word got around, and this led to an influx of thousands of people moving into the region. Furthermore, word finally got back to Lucia's mother regarding what had been happening with her daughter for the last few months. Once it did, she dealt very severely with her daughter. She began, Lucia says, sweetly with caresses and promises that all would be well if she told her mother what was going on. And then the confrontation escalated quickly, ending with Lucia being struck with a broomstick in order to prompt a confession of wrongdoing. The word of the secret spread even further, with the only thing that they said that was known about it is that it would be good for some, bad for others. This alerted the authorities, most notably the mayor of Fatima at the time, Arthur Santos. Santos was a vocal opponent of religious thought, especially Catholicism. He was a Freemason. And on the morning of August 13th, he kidnapped the three children and held them, interrogating them to reveal their secret. That, as well as the miracle of the sun and the events leading up to it, will be our subject for next week's episode. Jason?
Sam?
What do you think so far? I know you've said things throughout.
So far, it's kind of a lot of hearsay.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fine.
And we haven't quite got to anything really that we can break down and take a look at.
Nothing verifiable or even, yeah, yeah.
Not really.
Not even anything that does have a natural explanation, right?
Yeah.
As we'll see, a lot of this could have a natural explanation, but visions of hell from the hands of an apparition does not really have a natural explanation at all. So that's fair.
No, it doesn't, but it does have a bit of an explanation through, again, like old school religion in general.
Yes, for sure.
So could be a little bit of that playing into the whole situation as well. We don't know. I was not raised in the 19-teens in Portugal, so I have no idea kind of the religious context of the piety of their experiences and things like that. So that's the only thing that I can base this off of at this point in time because, well, the miracle is the big one that we're going to be talking about
next week.
So now, yeah, it's just kind of speculation and kind of taking everything with a grain of salt as far as these claims.
All right. Well, so with that, we'd just like to remind you that you can find us online at Twitter at Not Alone Pod, Facebook at Not Alone Podcast. You can join our Facebook group. Remember, we are not alone, a community for the strange. We do have an Instagram, and although we are updating a lot of things, we're not going to update that. I hate Instagram. I think it's the worst. I don't think I'm going to.
He's a TikTok guy.
But maybe we'll make a TikTok because I discovered TikTok recently and I love it. So in any case, and don't forget to go over to Not Alone Pod or your, patreon.com/notalonepodcast in order to learn more about supporting the show. And some of the very cool things you can get for supporting the show, including, again, merch, a book, multiple books, actually a book every other month that we then sit down and talk about as a family. That's right, family. And also stickers and handwritten thank you notes and birthday cards. That's right, birthday cards. You heard me right. Anyway, patreon.com/notalonepodcast. Who did it last week? And by last week, I, of course, mean a month and a half ago.
Yeah. I want to say...
I think it was me.
You're odd and I'm even.
Yeah, but I don't know what last was.
112.
No, it absolutely wasn't. It may have been 108, but it's not 112.
Oh. Yeah, well, you just go for it.
No, it was me.
Yeah, go ahead. You. Yeah.
That's awesome.
All right. Well, all right. Because like, oh, I remember this.
Yeah, I did right, really
so,
weird.
So, let's see here. Wait, are we not streamlining this portion then?
Oh no, we have to do this. This is our sign off. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well then, remember, whether you're shepherding your sheep with your family members, or you're catching a glimpse of something from beyond the veil. You are not alone.